You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
Hey, it's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in London, England. That's right, I'm here on my holidays. First time in my hometown for 3 years. And just across the way is Emily Hart. She is over as well, but we'll be doing this virtually because, well, she's recovering from COVID. I know you'll wish her all the best in that recovery. And it's kind of amazing how coherent and how on point she can be. And she is, of course. In this episode, in which is a great episode, 432, we are taking your questions. That's right, it's a question and answer episode about President-elect Gustavo Petro and some of his policies. We'll be taking those. Priority was given, or has been given, to our Patreon supporters. So if you want to get signed up for that and any benefits in the future, that's www.patreon.com/Columbia Calling. So we've got a bunch of questions, and of course we've kind of collated them a little bit because some sort of interconnect, but I think we've done some great answers, and we've got experts in their fields talking about security, human rights, and beyond. So we've slid in some voice packages sent from them over to this episode. Also, this episode is about the most English episode you could possibly get, because as we finish up the church nearby, the bells begin to chime. And so you'll hear that at the very end of the episode. Nothing I can do about that. And they went on and on and on. Please remember that the Columbia Calling podcast is sponsored by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean since 1967. Their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. And this episode is brought to you by BNB Colombia Tours, experts in custom-made travel throughout Colombia. The team at BNB Colombia Tours can provide you with fantastic private experiences, creating wonderful memories of Colombia for a lifetime. Check out the website at bnbcolombia.com. Complete the free itinerary form and tell them that Columbia Calling sent you to receive a further 5% off their already great prices.
Given I was out of action last week, here are your top stories for the first half of July 2022. The Truth Commission has published its long-awaited report on Colombia's armed conflict, a key milestone of the 2026 peace agreement with the FARC guerrilla group. The report is the result of 3 years of detailed study, with thousands of hours of interviews about Colombia's 6 decades of civil war, covering the causes of violence, as well as recommendations to various parts of the state to guarantee an ongoing peace. The report concludes that the main victims of the conflict with a civilian population. The commission now estimates that the conflict saw 451,000 murders, more than double the former official estimates. 45% of those murders were committed by paramilitaries, 21% by the FARC guerrilla, 4% by the ELN guerrilla, and 12% by state forces. 7.8 million people were displaced during the conflict, according to the report. Nearly half of those were children, and a further 1 million Colombians went into exile outside of the country, fleeing the conflict. One of the major findings of the commission was that the security model has not generated security, that it has, in fact, in many ways fueled the conflict, with too much military autonomy, acceptance of US intervention, and the use of civilians in security tasks, which led to paramilitarism. Drugs policy was another key theme of the report, which argues that the drugs trade and related corruption penetrated much of society, from politics to guerrilla and paramilitaries, and that a radical rethink of drugs policy will be required in order to achieve peace in Colombia. The report recommends a shift in focus towards regulation and away from prohibition. The lack of justice for many of the crimes committed was also under the spotlight in the report. Corruption in the judiciary and lack of cases opened were pinpointed as causes, as was extradition to the USA of Colombia's worst criminals, many of whom never faced justice for their crimes within the country, only facing drugs charges in the US. Other recommendations included advancing peace talks with the National Liberation Army, the ELN, tackling corruption, and guaranteeing quality of life and dignity for all of Colombia's communities. Documents used in the Truth Commission's report were obtained by the New York Times, who were able to reveal that the United States knew that the Colombian military was behind several assassinations of civil society leaders, and that the CIA had evidence of the Army's involvement in a 1988 massacre that left 20 dead. The CIA was also aware of alleged alliances between Army officials and members of the Medellin cartel. Other documents show that the US knew that some oil companies paid paramilitaries for protection or to gather intelligence. The USA continued, nonetheless, to deepen ties and provide support to the Colombian armed forces during the civil conflict. The Truth Commission's report itself will not have judicial implications. It is designed to pursue a more comprehensive idea of truth according to a social sciences framework, in order to offer a broad explanation of the complexity of the conflict and close the cycles of war in Colombia. In a so-called looting of peace, projects worth up to 250 billion Colombian pesos, around 50 million US dollars, were subject to mass corruption, in which kickbacks and bribes bled funds meant for implementing the peace process over the last 5 years. Blue Radio revealed that members of the government, the Comptroller's Office, and congressmen had set up a scheme to collect bribes in exchange for approving projects in Colombia's most conflict-affected municipalities. The Attorney General's Office has announced 24 disciplinary actions. President-elect Gustavo Petro has a 63% favorability rating, according to public opinion survey Pulso País, which also showed that President Iván Duque leaves office with an unfavorability rating of 60%. Vice President-elect Francia Márquez, meanwhile, will begin her term in office with a 68% favorability rating. Petro's preparation for taking power next month continues as he builds a broad coalition and holds talks with individuals and groups from across the political spectrum. He has now met with former president and leader of far-right party, the Centro Democrático, Álvaro Uribe, with whom he reportedly plans to maintain an open dialogue. Seven former paramilitary leaders have also announced plans to join Petro's national agreement. He has also proposed a bilateral ceasefire with the ELN, the last major rebel group in the country, in hopes of restarting stalled peace negotiations. Petro has now named numerous members of his cabinet, including poet Patricia Ariza as Minister of Culture, psychiatrist Carolina Corcho as Minister of Health, and political scientist Susana Muhammad as Minister of the Environment, working towards a parity government with 50% women. He has also appointed Álvaro Leiva to the Foreign Ministry and Alejandro Gaviria as Minister of Education. The Minister for the Environment has already announced that the door will be closed to fracking and glyphosate spraying of coca crops in Colombia. Her focus will instead be on solving socio-environmental conflicts in remote territories, reviewing environmental compliance for extractive megaprojects, and an effective strategy against deforestation. Notably, Petro has named José Antonio Ocampo as his finance minister, seen as a market-friendly choice. Ocampo has a PhD in economics from Yale University and is one of Colombia's most celebrated economists. Ocampo has announced taxation will be his priority, along with reindustrializing Colombia. He has also stated that the government is going to present a proposal for a wealth tax supported by many entities, but that if a wealth tax is imposed, it will not be on companies, but on individuals. While Petro continues to appoint officials, the chief of the armed forces, General Eduardo Zapatero, has resigned. Zapatero and Petro had a public falling out during the presidential campaign earlier this year, when Petro referred to the numerous army officials with links to narco paramilitary group the Gulf Clan. Zapatero responded on Twitter, calling Petro a narco politician. There is still little clarity on the alleged death of Iván Márquez, top leader of the Segunda Marquetalia FARC dissident group. While press occasionally confirm his death, President Iván Duque says verification is in process. Others say he survived the attack and is in intensive care in Venezuela, from where he was leading the group. The Segunda Marquetalia, meanwhile, insists that he is alive and suffered only minor injuries from the military attack on his base. Pride marches took place across the country last week, a celebration and a protest against ongoing violence and discrimination against LGBTQ plus people. On International Pride Day, the Ombudsman's Office presented its report on the human rights situation of LGBTQ plus people in Colombia. In 2021, there were recorded 47 murders. Already in 2022, there have been 33. Transgender women suffer extremely high levels of violence and hate crime. There has also been a significant increase in homicides of gay men. During the whole of 2021, there were 9 cases, while in the first 5 months of 2022, that figure rose to 18. The Ombudsman's Office draws attention to the existence of a possible pattern in these crimes in Medellin, where 11 cases were counted, and it has been reported that a killer is finding victims via dating app Grindr. The dollar reached its highest price in Colombian pesos in history this week, at more than 4,300. These figures come amid a tense international economic environment and the threat of recession in the USA. Those were your top stories for this week.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling, episode 432. I'm here in London, and Emily's here in London too. I apologize for my children in the background. Welcome, Emily. How is the recovery going?
Really, really slow.
We are 3 minutes away from one another, but we have to do this virtually.
We do. I've had a very unpleasant week with a very unpleasant variant of COVID, which all of London seems to have. So it's nice to be part of something, but it's very unpleasant to be part of this.
Now, is this the B5 or whatever it's called or something of that nature?
I'm afraid I've got no desire to give it a name whatsoever. It's taken 6 days of my life. I will not be giving it any more of my brain.
The plague, the hell. And I think some of our listeners have it too. I think they've mentioned it. So it's going around everywhere. But I'm glad you seem to be on the comeback trail, because when you sent me the voice message for 2 weeks ago, I guess it was, for that, it was like, I've heard toads croak more clearly. This is, I think, the best I can put it.
Yeah, stage one of this particular brand of plague was just the most extraordinary sore throat. And really, I mean, I looked as much like a toad as I sounded. I was really swollen up and weird. It was awful. And in Colombia, they're talking about a fifth wave as well. And they are talking about face masks.
Again?
So I'll be headed back to that soon. So will Richard. So that's something to look forward to.
I didn't know. I've been... And the other thing is, people are saying on Twitter, this is unrelated but related, that it seems to be no coincidence that we are back in the UK when Boris resigned. They seem to think it's connected.
I would love that to be the case. I would give the limb of anybody's choice to take credit for the downfall of that man. Unfortunately, I'm not completely sure he's going to be replaced by anybody better. Just a different brand of... I'm not sure which words I can say, because I can hear your children in the background.
And that's right. The door's closed, and I've got the headphones on, but don't offend anyone. People said to me, they've said on Twitter that we're definitely MI6 in some way. So there you go.
I'd have made a terrible, terrible spy, but it's a lovely fan.
But that's it. I mean, that's it. You're hiding in plain sight, and what can we say? Like, yeah. Anyhow, let's go in. We've got questions. We've got lots of questions and good questions. And they kind of, you know, a lot of them are sort of cross-section questions between them. A lot about fear, a lot about uncertainty and petrol. So shall we just read out some and go from there? Do you want to start, Emily?
Yes, I've actually paraphrased them on my notebook, though, so it might be better if you do it to
get
the words of the listeners.
Okay, so listen, I'm going to read Tigran's first, because it's the last to arrive, actually. Tigran said, you know, fear, uncertainty, and doubt. They say that the incoming, God, I can't read my, the president, is a liar, criminal, and wants to take their savings, tax, everything. They advise, people advise on waiting, on making any investment into property or businesses in Colombia. In your circles, what are the reactions? At the same time, Julian has said, what is already happening before the inauguration of the new president? Are people really afraid? And are they already pulling their money out of Colombia in all? Or is it all hat and no cattle? As there's so much rumor, and Petro wanting to make a second Venezuela out of Colombia, could you discuss what would happen and what could happen? What could be the best case scenario and the worst case scenario for Colombia? And finally, on this one, there's Javier as well. How's he going to stop the financial flight? That's paraphrased. People are taking their money out of Colombia and buying property in Miami. How can we attract investors? And what's he going to do about inflation? So I kind of think they all sort of feed into the same thing.
You can jump in first,
and then I'll jump in.
Yeah. Well, first thing, whether or not you agree with the concerns, they are very real and very sincerely felt by a lot of people in Colombia. And I think the mistake of a lot of commentators and journalists is to disregard them as silly or unrealistic. And the first thing that you have to do is acknowledge them and ask why they're there. Not just because they're real and sincerely felt, but because they also have very serious effects on governability, on financial flight, and also the extent to which the international market and the international community, particularly major allies to the north, allow this government to govern. These things do matter. In terms of my own circle, people I've spoken to, there are people who are quite concerned. My immigrant Venezuelan friends immediately tried to get all of their money out of Colombia. Some other friends had a party. You know, my friends are as divided as the country is. I don't think Petro wants to make Colombia another Venezuela, because nobody wants any country to be another Venezuela. Nobody thinks that's been a success. Nobody. And he does not have ambitions to recreate that model. Nobody does. And while Colombia is not by any means a perfect democracy, I think if he's a liar and a criminal, there will be consequences. There are a lot of eyes on him. So in terms of fears, yes, he's on the left. That's new. That makes people nervous. I don't think he's going to achieve a new Venezuela in 4 years. I think there are checks and balances in place to stop that happening, even were he to wish that, which I don't think that he does.
I'm on 100% on your side on that one with Venezuela. I mean, as I've said on TV and I've said in other places, is the biggest red flag is having Venezuela alongside Colombia. I mean, you know, is there a country that better knows and has better experienced, aside from Venezuela, but from being a neighbor to Venezuela? Mm-hmm. I think on the Venezuela topic, he is right to open dialogue with President Maduro. And, you know, open dialogue, get something done on that border, get something done, because at the end of it all, it's the Venezuelans who are suffering, and we have to have a relationship with our neighbor. What you said about all of this and the uncertainty, he doesn't want to turn it into Venezuela.
we don't have the oil money in the boom that Venezuela had. And he certainly doesn't have the full backing of the army, the armed forces. There's that.
Which I think leads really interestingly into one of Becky's questions about strongman politics and whether or not, or even where in the global trend of strongman political leaders being elected or, you know, non-strongman leaders being elected and over various electoral cycles becoming strongman leaders, you know, the really big, dangerous, quote unquote, strongman leaders do have the complete backing of the army. And Petro does not. We've just seen the retirement of Zapatero, which is sort of clearly a throwing toys out the pram protest resignation. Is English my first language? Impossible to say.
Did you study English literature?
I couldn't say. It was too long ago. So yeah, he hasn't got that, which makes him much less dangerous over the short term. You know, there are leaders who wield very powerful militaries against their people and against government institutions. El Salvador is an example. Sending the military to the Supreme Court in his first little bit as president, old Bukele. So we have lots of checks and balances. I think often the strong men who are elected to power are elected in response to a major demand for a big issue that people want fixed and think they need a strong man to fix. Those issues are often security or corruption. In fact, I'm not sure that's what happened in this election. No, go ahead.
Becky was talking about the sort of increasing preference for authoritarian strongman rulers. Let's not dismiss the fact that Petro does have authoritarian or could have authoritarian tendencies. He's not very good at delegating, and he's not very good at conciliation, but that said, he has sat down with his, with his opposite number. He sat down with Rodolfo Hernandez, who came second in the elections. Rodolfo Hernandez, and who I'm still unsure as to what he was, right, left, policy, whatever.
He is too.
Yeah.
It's fine.
And he has sat down with he who shall not be named, Alvaro Uribe, and I just named him. And that is a question. A question from Tom, who said, "Is this a reason for hope? The photo of Uribe and Petro, is it a collaboration, or is it proof that Uribe still hasn't clocked that he is becoming less relevant by the day? Or option C, is it both? Or option D, is it neither?" I think there's a bit of everything there.
And I'm of the view that it's both.
Yeah.
Uribe will struggle to accept his new role in politics, but he does still have an enormous relevance and enormous sway, not just over the major opposition party in Congress, who are the Centro Democrático, and a number of major politicians who still toe his line, but also over big swathes of the population. And again, we're talking about governability, we're talking about popular mandate, and there are still a lot of people listening to what Uribe says. For me, it was more, in a lot of these meetings and acceptances of different voices in the coalition, and more evidence that Petro maybe isn't a strong man in the mold that we're seeing. And I don't want to sound too, millennial about it, but I think the phrase toxic masculinity, or just straight up machismo, is a lot of what we're seeing with some of these leaders. If someone disagrees, they throw a tantrum, they throw their toys out the pram, they call that person a traitor of the people. I mean, I'm particularly talking about Bolsonaro and the Supreme Court. These are men who don't know how to be disagreed with.
Yeah.
And they feel threatened by that. And we're seeing a lot of the opposite with Petro. People who have been, who have said very unflattering things about him in the very recent past, I wouldn't sit down and have a coffee with someone who'd said that kind of thing about me a month afterwards. Good on him. I'm not seeing a lot of the ego that he's famous for in these meetings. And that to me is very encouraging.
I had we had a politician and opposition at that time. Politicians stay with us in Mompos a couple of times, and he asked us our opinion on Petro regarding that kind of toxic masculinity. And we said, well, you know, I said, whatever happens, I hope that he's got over this ability to appear arrogant the whole time. And this opposition politician was like, he's been working on that fundamentally for months, if not years now, to bring that down. I wanted, before you jumped in, I wanted to say something about the Uribe photo opportunity. I mean, we all looked at it and the memes came out and it was all hilarious. Yes. And sometimes there was hope, sometimes not. But Uribe, when he came out of it and sort of, you know, posed for the cameras and talked about private property and that his... He consolidated his role as now the voice, let's say the stable voice, if we can say that, of the opposition for that moment. You know, I think it was very clever. You know, I think that his star is waning, but as you say, there's a whole load of people who will still listen to what he has to say and still believe him blindly. Or so, but I thought it was very clever the way he did that. And he came out talking about private property, which was, for me, interesting because, of course, that's one of the key things. You know, Petro's going to take your pensions, he's going to tax you, and he's going to appropriate all the land. So I thought that was very interesting.
Very interesting, and ties into what Tigran asked, which is, you know, people saying that Petro is going to take their savings and their tax assets of middle-class Colombians. And by all accounts, that's not the plan.
No.
Taking the assets of the middle class would never be a sensible plan. he has brought in Ocampo, who I think we should, you know, mention if we're talking about finance. He's his new finance minister. You know, he's a Yale economist. He's worked at the UN. He's had various posts in government. And he's seen as a real, you know, pacifier for the market, right? Mm. But even he is talking about a wealth tax.
Mm.
But that's not middle classes.
No.
Those are your moneyed elites, and the wealth tax is for individuals and not for businesses. So they really are, they will go after private property because that's how taxation works. That's tax. Some of your private property goes to the state, and in return, you and people less fortunate than you get public services without paying for them. That's just how a state is run. So yes, some private property will be taken. It's called tax.
That's the questions from Harry, aren't they, as well? A lot of the issues of the, you know, the fiscal issues, pension, and of course agrarian reform. I think obviously there's a lot to be unwrapped in the whole fiscal side, but I think Ocampo is... it's positive. And we know for a fact that Petro is surrounded by academics who have studied this to, you know, they may or may not be friends of his, but they will provide pushback, which is something we haven't seen in the previous 4 years. They will provide pushback when he needs to be pushed back. And I think that's something that we need to respect and appreciate. But yes, taxes. I don't even know what the percentage of actually tax income is in Colombia, but we know it's very low.
It's very low. And the agrarian form will provide another form of tax income on an industry that is not very taxed, rarely taxed meaningfully at all, according to the new minister, Celia Lopez, I think, who's going to be doing the agrarian reform. So if they make that sector more productive, and they do manage to actually tax it and do some form of agrarian reform by which people have access to land, you know, that could be a drive for the economy. That's Petro's plan. That's what he says. You know, and the way that he distinguishes his plan from that of Venezuela is that it will not be oil-driven development. Mm. He says that agriculture will be the new oil of Colombia. That's a big ask. I mean, we actually didn't get any questions specifically about agrarian reform because it's quite dull and knotty, and I get that. but it is going to be a big focus, I think. You know, well, it's 200 years overdue, much like a government that's interested in social reform. and it's got Celia Lopez, who's a pretty impressive pretty impressive woman in her 70s, big history behind her, but she's up against some of the most powerful people in the country. Mm. I mean, the cattle ranchers, I mean, that makes them sound like cowboys. We're talking huge landowners and enormous businesses who are historically immensely corrupt and linked to some quite dangerous, violent people. If we're getting direct about it, which apparently I just did, that's who she's up against. That's what this reform is pushing up against. So it's a big one.
Yeah, Colombia is the country which hasn't had a land reform in South America. I mean, let's go there and point one on the peace accords, on almost anything. And so they will have to do something about this. They will have to. I don't know where you start. I don't know where it goes, but there has to be something. There has to be. And of course, it comes into, of course, protected lands, stolen lands, displaced people. It adopts everything. And of course, you bring in the tax side. Now, that extractive industry that you, obviously, people asked about that. Ben asked about the analysis relating to Petro's plans for extractives. It doesn't, to me, I'll stick my neck out, seem unreasonable that Gustavo Petro has a plan to adopt all renewables within 12 years. That's the plan as I know it. Everything that has been signed off on in terms of extractives continues, but nothing more. Obviously, there's a big problem if things get caught in limbo. Obviously, this is a huge deal for international investors. But I also think on the flip side, an international community and international governments are also happy to see, progressives, happy to see a country coming, let's say, in a post-accord situation. I don't even know what I'd say, because I'm not going to say post-conflict, but post-accord situation, moving towards these sort of ideals. I think it's a positive thing. I don't know if saying or misquoting Petro on extractives was ever a good thing. It was the easiest thing to attack him on. A huge portion of Colombia's, if not most of it, Colombia's economy comes from these things. So do we think that he will go down the route of sort of, how do I say it, Boric in Chile, where he promised a lot of things and then watered it down immensely?
I think he'll have to, won't he? I mean, that is also totally normal. You get into government with an enormous raft of plans that you then have 4 years and a budget, a Congress, and a political opposition in order to reform. I mean, this is totally normal governance stuff. Sandra Botero, who's an amazing political analyst, I often pester in order to get a... ideas and analysis from, said, that's totally to be expected. Mm-hmm. And it's very possible that will be painted as exceptional. Mm-hmm. Because, there is a big opposition to Petro and lots of people. I mean, he said himself, and I will, for my subscribers, translate and share this interview with Petro in El País, because it's a really amazing piece of long form. And he says, this is it. If we fail, and I quote, "The darkness will come and sweep everything away." That's literally what he said. I think he's acutely aware of the stakes.
Yeah.
And if he fails, that will be evidence that the left does not work in Colombia or that the left cannot work in Latin America. But it is totally reasonable to expect that only a small proportion of the promises or the electoral campaign promises will be fulfilled. I think that's normal. And I think he's very prepared for that. Mm. He's certainly implemented ministers. Ocampo has already moderated a lot of what was promised, which is a great comfort to a lot of people too, I think.
That was, who was it who said that about, hang on a second, let me just check through, because someone said something interesting. Zach. And he says, Petro's selection of finance minister was designed to instill confidence and stability. Is this a harbinger of his financial policies, or merely a nod to international financial markets? What is the likelihood that Petro will be hamstrung in any large-scale financial reform, similarly to how he was hamstrung in some ways as the mayor of Bogota, or does he have a critical mass in Congress to support dramatic reforms? And that kind of feeds into Harry's other question about the sort of breakdown. Critical mass, I mean, on paper, he now has a majority with the Liberal Party and the U Party. So that's the Party of National Unity, the U Party. But of course, they are as flip-floppy as they want to be on anything and everything. And if Cesar Gaviria, former president, who has thrown his toys a few times in the last couple of months, Petro knew he had to make a deal with him because he wouldn't otherwise, I mean, it would have been impossible. Petro has known he has to get the U Party on board, but that was largely done by, of course, Benedetti and Roy Barreras, who he brought on, you know, very, very capable political chameleons, I think the best way of putting it. He has on paper a majority. That does not mean that anything is going through.
Neither do they have the sort of three-line whip system that we have here in the UK, where people are forced to vote along party lines, right? So there's lots of opportunity for in-party dissent. I think my only real response is that we'll see.
Yeah, it's hard, that one.
Yeah.
The breakdown, obviously, as you can see, a breakdown. Do you have the figures on the breakdown for Harry?
On Congress?
Yeah.
I actually had the Registraduría app and it has broken.
Doesn't sound unusual.
The website is such garbage. I do, in one of my old notes for my briefing, have the congressional outline. And Sia Vacia, actually, let me... Also, Richard, I think there's something hitting up against your microphone, or maybe it's like a pen tapping.
Oh, right, I will stop that.
But it's a really loud.
It's a pen because I'm like that.
Ah, okay. I think it's just quite close to the mic, is all.
Okay.
Okay, let me. I do always recommend Sia Vacia for graphics. Mm-hmm. They just they really put together a good graphic. Equally on the Truth Commission report, they've done some really good stuff.
Fantastic report. Hard going. Fantastic. You must mention that. And that Gustavo Petro was there for the inauguration of the report is very important. And in keeping with his presidency, Ivan Duque was in Portugal protecting oceans.
Yeah, classic. Classic Ivan, that.
I mean, honestly, of all things. But then again, are we surprised? No.
No, deeply not. I think, you know, he is slowly tapping out, paving the way to become, I mean, my bet's on highly paid international environmental consultant.
Yep.
And we'll all find that darkly amusing, but that's where my money is for his, you know, if Tony Blair can be one of the world's best paid Middle Eastern consultants, nearly said a different word there, then who knows for Duque, you know?
Yeah, you know, and Uribe went up and did classes at Georgetown, and so there you go.
it's all to play for, because there are not enough eyes on this country, and people can get away with all kinds of rubbish in the aftermath of their own actions. Okay, here we are. Yeah. I've found, because of all of that mess with preconteo and scrutiny, obviously it all got a little bit confused. Right, so Pacto Histórico has 19. So it is the biggest party in Congress.
And that is as well, you have a coalition of leftist parties. So it's not as if they're going to blindly vote with him as well.
Right. I mean, this is the thing again, and about not having a whip system, is that you can count your seats, but not your chickens, I think would be the simplest way to put this. And again, you know, lots of negotiation happens. He's still appointing ministers. We've got a real broad church in terms of ministers, lots of different experiences, lots of different parties being brought in. So it does matter. And if people are pissed off with Petro or the coalitions fall apart, that will be difficult because he does not have a majority. But in terms of what positively could happen, I think it'll depend on the proposal. and on the lobbying. You know, there are lots of interests in Colombia outside of things that count, the things that people voted for, that will be huge factors in whether or not Petro can fulfill his party promises.
Jump in at that moment, because I did see someone write about, you know, there won't be protests because Petro and Francia Márquez are you know, supported by those who got out and protested. And I think that was totally off base, because the people who are most likely to go out and protest, I think, are the people who voted for Petro. If he doesn't fulfill some of the promises, in particular, I would say, you know, security for social community leaders, land reform, peace accords, and environmental considerations. I think those were many of the issues that got people out into the streets. And now, of course, inflation and you know, cost of living. And I think he will be given a small amount of time and will have to sort of, you know, hang that carrot ahead of the donkey, giving, you know, a nibble at a time to keep them pleased. Because otherwise, I think they'll go out on the streets.
I agree. I also think it's something of a myth that only lefties protest.
Mm-hmm.
There are lots of things that could get people out on the streets. There are lots of people who weren't on the streets before who might now get out on the streets. The number of protests that are listed by ACLED, who's a really interesting think tank, who does a lot of research on, which does a lot of research on protest activity, riots, and civil unrest, as well as on conflict. They register an enormous number of anti-democratic protests. So protests, you know, Bolsonaro was able to call enormous protests against the Supreme Court, some of which were calling for military rule again. Protests are not just about peace and human rights. Protests can be about lots of things. So we could well be facing more street demonstrations. I don't think we'll reach the level of the Paro Nacional again, but I certainly do think it's a rather specific right-wing Colombian take that Petro was the reason that people were on the streets and his lot will not get on the streets again. He certainly allied himself to those protests.
Of course.
But I certainly don't believe he was the reason for them.
I was annoyed at that whole thing of him taking, he took, you know, tried to take some credit, didn't he? He tried to take some, and that annoyed me a bit because it took away from the, because there was at the beginning, and there was when in Bogota more than anywhere, I think, an organic kind of growth to them. And then Petro getting in obviously gave fuel to his detractors. And let's recall, this election really wasn't about policy. It was Petro, yes or no. Let's remember that. It was, are you voting for Petro or are you not? And 10 million people voted against. They voted no. And so this is going to be hard.
It definitely is. And honestly, I wrote an article on this, so might be biased, but a lot of the people who voted for Petro weren't even voting for Petro. They were voting for Francia Márquez. And if she doesn't get the profile and the amount of power that her voters believe that she is due, I think that could be another obstacle to having a real popular mandate for him, because certainly she was not stood behind him. She was stood beside him. She was on the campaign materials. She was right out there gaining him voters. And if we look at the vote changes to the left, a lot of them were in her homelands, places she voted. A lot of people I spoke to in Cauca, on the Pacific, on the Caribbean, said, we did not vote for Petro. We voted for Francia. He would not have won without her. There are people who are unequivocal in that belief. And honestly, a lot of the vote analysis totally stands behind that. Since the election, I've seen a lot less of her. There's been a lot of, you know, putting nice, shiny Ocampo, white men who've studied at Yale forwards to soothe the markets, to soothe, you know, the opposition. But I think it's important in this government to remember who and why actually got the votes. who actually got the votes and why. I haven't spoken much at all in the last 6 days because I've been in bed and my English is, sure what's going on there.
That's okay. And I think you're again, totally on point with the Francia Márquez. And I know of people, anti-Petristas, who voted for Pedro because of Francia Márquez. Of course, she's vice president, so he can't kick her out. That's the rule for vice presidency. And she will have a strong line on the environment and, of course, traditional communities and overseen, or what are they called? The nadies, the nobodies in
Los
the country.
Los Nadie. Yeah, which is always to be put in quote marks because it's a quote from a great poem by Eduardo Galeano, who wrote The Open Veins of Latin America as well as a lot of great poetry. Mm. And that is a poem very specifically about the marginalized of Latin America. Mm-hmm. And I do think it's important to note that was edited out of every article I wrote for the Times. Just going to throw that in there as a bitter aside.
They're not listening.
This is too much. Nobody cares about this. I think it's important because nobody, to have it outside of quotes or outside of context, certainly outside of Colombia, you forget that she was never saying they were nobody. Nobody believes they're nobody.
Yeah.
Within the left and, you know, most social movements, that's a really famous poem, and Los Nadies is a really specific reference.
Yeah. Well, we've got some questions about security. Martin has asked about violence increased or decreased since the Petro win. Frankly, I couldn't tell you. I would imagine it's continuing. I would imagine that people are getting, I hate to say it, the groups or whomever are getting things done before August 9th, when Petro gets in. And it's business as usual, I would imagine, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my news monitoring, massacres continue, murders of former FARC combatants continue. Neither candidate took a particularly strong stance on security. You know, law and order was really Fico's line. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that went when he did. Lots of, I think, very good structural proposals from Petro about how to limit the power of armed groups in the long term. I don't imagine they'll be quaking in their boots in the short term. Mm. The Colombian army currently has no general. Neither candidate proposed any particular policy for the short term. And I think that is something, you know, and I'm not a law and order security right winger, though I have written on these issues a bit. There are a lot of people living in pretty difficult circumstances that need an immediate solution, and not just a humanitarian one, a security one. Mm. And neither candidate proposed that, and I've not seen much on that since. So certainly they'll be getting on with business. I think under Hernandez, it would have been a free-for-all, quite frankly. I don't think the man had a clue. He certainly didn't have allies in the security or military sector. But that's definitely a valid concern as far as I'm concerned. You know, what is going to be done in the short term? Mm.
And Rich asked that, human rights defenders, are things going to get better for them?
So the U.S. Biden administration's response to the Petro win was actually surprisingly very good. Anthony Blinken contacted him, and then he had a formal conversation with President Biden, something that happened very quickly after the win, much faster than Duque, which took months, and really was a signal that the U.S. was going to be willing to work with him. In Congress, many Democrats saluted the win, like Gregory Meeks, James McGovern of Massachusetts, Cori Bush, Ilhan Omar, and several others. So there was definitely a willingness from people from key committees in the Congress, including the Tom Lantos Human Rights Committee, Western Hemisphere Subcommittee in the House, to continue to work with Colombia in terms of business as usual. prior to the election, Francia had come to Washington, D.C., and the State Department did not meet with her, neither did the White House. And a high-level State Department delegation that had gone a few months prior to the election went to Colombia, met with all of the presidential candidates except for Petro. So this was a pleasant surprise that this happened. At the same time, the right-wing Cubans in the Congress, like Maria Elvia Salazar from southern Florida, very good friend of President Uribe, the days of the elections posted tweets saying that Petro was basically a communist and that basically Colombia was going completely downhill, and that incredibly worried about how this is going to affect Colombians, but they stand by with them in solidarity. I think there's going to be part of this right-wing wing that's going to probably be in opposition to changes in Colombia because they're very allied with this Cold War notion of Latin America, where they see this Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and now Colombia axis against the freedom-loving and security-focused pro-business alliance that is some of the other countries in which Colombia has been heading, basically, for the past 200 years in this relationship. This is the first time Colombia has a progressive government, and so they have been definitely expressing concern and that kind of thing. However, we've seen that overall the policy is very bipartisan towards Colombia, and it's in the interest of both countries for the relationship to continue, not just because of commercial reasons, but for the anti-narcotics reasons, security reasons, and also because Colombia is the main country that houses most Venezuelans fleeing the situation in Venezuela, in a region where many other countries have basically not been open and friendly to Venezuelans, or at least not to have them permanently there. So I think that they're going to have to figure out ways to work together. The points where there may be contention have to do with Petro's economic policies, or the stated economic policies, his idea to wean Colombia off of its dependency on oil and extractives, which is a major part of the free trade agreements that Colombia has signed in the world, but mostly the one with the U.S. And Canada. You know, up until now, each Colombian administration has seen extractives as a way to build wealth in the country and as a way to increase the economy. Unfortunately, that wealth isn't well distributed, as we know, hence all of the conflicts in the country. But also, it's a wealth that's actually not even particularly good for the Colombian government itself, because most of it really goes to the multinationals and those who work with multinationals in Colombia. And so I think that that's where you're going to have a certain points of contention. And he said that he wants to renegotiate this agreement and also make basically fossil fuels really for domestic internal consumption. This runs against a problem that the Biden administration has right now that's weighing heavily on them with the November elections, the congressional elections here in the United States, whereby Biden is heavily criticized due to the inflation and the high gas prices because of this whole foray with Ukraine and Russia and the sanctions and so forth. And so Biden himself, despite the fact that his one of his main mandates is to address climate change and to move the Paris Agreement and so forth, is actually regressing in laxing a lot of its targets in terms of environment, and that's happening domestically, and it's seeking help from countries around the world, especially Colombia, who's its main friend in the region on this front. And so I think there will be some bones of contention. On the Amazon, supposedly the Petro and Biden spoke, and they agreed to see how they could work together on preserving the Amazon and having the same goals, mutual goals there. So on that front, yes, but on the front of the economic impact of particular changes that may happen under the Petro administration as it shifts its economy to more renewable resources, as it says it wants to do, might be problematic. On the drug policy front, I mean, the Petro administration says it would work with the U.S. government. It's made it very clear, does it want to renew aerial fumigation with glyphosate. But at the same time, that hasn't been happening because Colombia's own courts have stopped it, and because of what was agreed to in the peace accord. Now, Petro wants to put a lot of emphasis in implementing the PINIS, which is basically the plan to help make coca farmers transition to alternative economies. And, you know, as we've seen up to this point, that hasn't been well implemented. And so, you know, his plan is to basically bolster all of that and then look at some of the, what they call like macro criminal aspects of the drug trade. The point is that all of those changes, until we start seeing that having a dent in the level of coca hectares grown, is going to take a while. So the question is, how is the U.S. going to react when we see that there isn't an immediate dip in coca, and when they look to certify next year? Now, the Biden administration has also said that it wants to have a more holistic approach to basically determining whether or not there have been improvements in anti-narcotics efforts that doesn't just focus on the coca leaf, but other measures, which if Petro follows through with what he's pretending to follow through on, would fit very nicely with what the Biden administration wants to do. I think that they could see eye to eye there. We will see that that things might work. But given that generally these are long-term solutions, and this is a chronic and incredibly difficult problem, and especially given all the shocks that the economy has gone through in the region, but specifically Colombia due to the pandemic and so forth, that there may be some tension there moving forward. Beyond that, there appears to be support. Obviously, it's a bipartisan support. If you look at the U.S. economic package to Colombia towards implementing the peace, so I don't think there'll be any problem there. Improving institutions, even I think the additional police training funds that the U.S. is given under Duque to address basically the police brutality and abuses. You know, the fact that Petro wants to move the police from under the Ministry of Defense to somewhere else, all of those things I don't think are going to be a big problem, because the U.S. usually points to what Colombia wants to do in terms of police reforms. So I don't think that that's going to be a major issue. The other area where I think there's going to be increased cooperation is on ethnic and minority issues. So Francia Marquez, the vice president, is going to put together this Ministry of Equity. And this Ministry of Equity looks at not just women's rights, LGBT rights, Afro-Colombian and indigenous and ethnic rights, something that the Petro government plan includes as something that they're going to strengthen and help actually even give more autonomy in terms of environmental management to some of the indigenous areas of the country, and also to give Raizal peoples more control over their territories. So I think that that ministry and those efforts really follow in line what the U.S. has already done. The U.S. is the number one donor to Afro-Colombian indigenous issues. There is a U.S.-Colombia racial action plan that's been around under various administrations. And the U.S. has pushed and helped the Afro-Colombian indigenous movement with their integration of the ethnic chapter into the final peace accord. So the question is, if the CAPRI, which is the U.S.-Colombia Racial Action Plan, gets restarted, because it really fell by the wayside under Duque, under Petro, what we hope to see is that it will be framed within the ethnic chapter. This plan is to do exchanges between non-governmental entities, agencies, and others between U.S. and Colombia that benefit both African Americans, Afro-Colombians, Indigenous, and Native Americans. And we strongly believe, as our partners, that it should focus on consolidating and complementing the policies that the U.S. is actually putting in place and the programs it already has in place. So within USAID, there is a program called the Inter-Ethnic Alliance for Peace that seeks to implement the ethnic chapter on the ground in multiple territories. It is led and implemented by Afro-Colombian and Indigenous groups themselves. It's the first time ever you have this type of arrangement. And so the U.S. Racial Action Plan should basically complement that, not be something apart and new. There's no reason to do that. So I think that we're going to see a lot more opening there and perhaps a lot more prioritization of Afro-Colombian women issues, gender issues, LGBT issues as well.
Hard one. I would imagine that Petro will make some statements whether things can be carried out in these regions. And of course, if he doesn't have the full backing of the military, we don't really know what's going to happen with the security plans and the use of the security forces. One of Petro's statements has been to separate the police force from the Ministry of Defense, which many people have been calling for a long time.
Including the UN.
Including the UN. And of course, I think it was mentioned in the Truth Commission as well, all of these things. Mm. So hopefully he can move forward on that, because this is not about national sovereignty. This is about a sort of internal, what would you call it? Cohabiting in this land.
Right. Yeah. And I think in terms of, I think there are levels of human rights defense. In terms of citizens being on the streets, we are going to see improvements, particularly if the police come out from under the Ministry of Defense, which is a uniquely Colombian phenomenon, one very tied up with the civil war and the narco wars, perhaps legitimate in that time.
Late 1980s, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there is no excuse for that any longer. We do not need militarized police forces. That sort of police force's interaction with protests, according to all research and data, immediately creates or exacerbates violence at protests. Mm-hmm. Those are the facts. Those are what the studies say. So in terms of that, we are going to see improvements, I think. In terms of the human rights defenders who are being murdered in Colombia's rural regions, because Colombia has the highest number of murdered human rights defenders in the world per year, again, third year running. Mm-hmm. And they also have 40% of the global total. So it's not just a bit more. And the next two countries down are Brazil and Mexico. So we know what the causes are. We know what the patterns are. Whether or not Petro is able to get a handle on security and armed groups in the short term will be the deciding factor on that. But we do again have Francia Marquez. We finally have someone in government who actually has experience of these things. She was an activist, she has been threatened by armed groups, and she survived an assassination attempt. So it's not simply that she really cares about these issues, it's also that she understands at a granular level how these things happen and what the context is. So we may see a policy that actually makes sense in context.
So with this in mind, we're going to slide in a voice file here from expert on security issues, Kyle Johnson, and he will have updates for us on this and his thoughts. He was on the podcast many, many months ago talking about Arauca, talking about what's going on, the different armed groups controlling different areas. He spends a lot of time on the border. And so that's, we'll obviously put in the show notes his company and everything else, so to follow up. So we'll have this now.
So, I mean, the main security concerns are kind of like twofold, or we could divide them in two ways. First, like quantitatively, is that in the last few years, the conflict has been intensifying according to pretty much every indicator, humanitarian and of violence, direct violence related to the conflict. So, I mean, the security concern is how to buck this trend, right? At least how can we stop the increase in violence and the increase in the humanitarian effects of that violence, maybe displacement, confinement, killings of social leaders, killings of ex-combatants. So that did drop in 2021 compared to 2020. But also, you know, landmine victims, which is, the numbers are still lower than before, but they're on the uptake. And then just intensity of the conflict, the killings in PEDET or conflict-affected regions, combats between armed groups, combats between the army. You've got a whole slew of indicators that are showing things are getting worse. So how to buck that trend? That's like the first kind of question that this government will have to deal with. So that's like the first part. And then I think the second side of things is the more qualitative, is how can you have a security policy that best responds to the new context that we have? Because the security policy under Duque obviously was inadequate. It was unable to decrease the violence despite, you know, killing multiple leaders of armed groups or important commanders of armed groups. Well, the violence was still pretty high, or continued to increase. It wasn't necessarily high, but it continued to increase. And so the second thing is, how do you get a security policy that best responds to a context of multiple armed groups or fragmentation within the armed conflict? That can best also prioritize the protection of civilians over necessarily, you know, attacking armed groups, or that at least doesn't equate attacking armed groups with the protection of civilians, because those are not the same thing necessarily. I think we've seen that quite a bit, especially in like Southern Chocó and in Cauca and Nariño and even in Arauca. So I think that's going to be another key, is like, how can security policy shift to the new context? I think those kind of are like not only the concerns, but like a bit of the kind of the questions and challenges that the government will have to deal looking at these concerns. Obviously, the concern of an intensifying armed conflict is part of point one, and then part of point two is the concern of a changing landscape of armed conflict as well. And then so those are going to be the challenges. I'm not sure how Petro will come about them. I think regarding at least some part of security policy, he's going to look to address the structural issues behind all of these issues, but that will only cover part of the story. Those take a long time, and so he'll need a policy that can address. He'll need a military policy, basically, whether he likes it or not. He's going to need more coercive policy as well to complement those, to kind of do the short-term work while the other long-term stuff, you know, kind of gets going. But also, I think the interesting question is going to be negotiations, possible negotiations, La Paz Total, as they call it, total peace between the armed groups. How he approaches this issue, how he approaches each armed group, the methodological questions, the political questions, etc., are going to be very, very difficult, obviously. I mean, if peace negotiations with one armed group are already very complex, with multiple armed groups, they're going to be even more complex. And this is especially true. I mean, ELN have their own difficulties negotiating with MD. The Clan del Golfo as well, now that Chiquito Malo is the head of the group, what does that mean for negotiations? It's going to be tough to tell. And then with dissidents, it's getting difficult as more and more different dissident commanders get killed off, especially on the side of Segundo Marquetalia, but, you know, also on Gentil's side, Gentil, who's now dead. The question of what is their position on negotiating becomes even more difficult to answer. And then who do you negotiate with is also going to become increasingly difficult to answer if these commanders keep getting killed, even in Venezuela. So I think those are kind of going to be like the three main questions or issues for the on the policy side of things. I don't think we have the answers quite yet, but Petro is not even in power yet. So he doesn't have a lot of time, but he has some time to figure things out. And I think some of those policy questions are going to depend on who he names, what is his relationship with the armed forces looks like, and a bunch of other things. But
and then coming back from that, we'll come back. And we need to talk about, Emily, we need to talk about, I'm trying to look at, see who else has written. There's been, you know, one of the things is, you know, I was talking to a Colombian the other day here in London who was saying, you know, he saw people crying when Petro got in, which I think is kind of extreme. I mean, people, one, and a friend of my wife said, you know, Richard is very, very left wing. And she went, he really isn't. He's just very critical. It's just very critical. And then the friend was like, yeah, you're right. We do have the worst.
I think there's also something to be said here for a centering of the United States on the political spectrum. Imagining that the US is a sort of neutral zero point on the barometer of politics, and that Colombia is only just to the right. And anyone who thinks that a state should provide services or charge taxes is somehow very left wing. And in terms of Colombia's history, we are looking at historic leftness. But if we look at the global context, you know, further than the frankly fascist and crass, unrestrained capitalist goings on of the United States of only the last 2 weeks, not even to speak on the general political system,
alienate.
I mean, the banning of abortion, the unrestrained sale of arms, and saying that the country has no right to rule on carbon outputs. I mean, this is not a neutral space that we're talking about, and it must not be used as one on a political barometer. You know, as a person from Europe, we have a national health service. We have taxes of between 40 and 50% on the highest earnings of the wealthy, and we do not consider ourselves socialist. Mm-mm. You know, I think we have to take into account the context, but also pull out a bit and say, okay, so, you know, is left or right a useful, meaningful way to talk about this? And how left-wing is it really in the global context, a lot of what's being proposed?
I just think a lot of it's just, yeah, again, coming from a European context, it just doesn't seem outrageous.
No, again, and if you said to even the most right-wing people in Colombia, you know, would you like to live in a country that looks like Sweden? A lot of them would say, yes, that sounds great, thank you. And that's a country where taxes are incredibly high, even by European standards.
Yeah.
And so are public services and maternity leave and benefits. I mean, what's considered socialist and what isn't is uneven and often unfair. I found one of my own articles on a tweet or being tweeted with the expression socialist regime. Before Petro has even taken power, a certain newspaper's Twitter manager decided that it's a socialist regime.
Wow. And you were tweeted on that?
Yes, luckily not tagged. but I certainly hadn't used the expression. You know, the word regime is a rather strong one. not one that I would pick, but you see what I mean. I mean, there's a real unevenness to the way that we label governments and policies, depending on where we're from and how big our perspective is.
This puts in quite an interesting comment. I think it's from, hang on a second, looking here. It's Rich again. So this puts Colombia kind of, what do you think about Colombia on the world stage with Petro in power? And I think there's something incredibly positive from it. I mean, I think there's something positive that hopefully it's someone who can go overseas and present a more, I don't know, human face, maybe? I don't know. But I guess if people are shifting left, shifting right, as you say, or don't want to say, is this a bad thing? I don't know. We're everywhere, aren't we? All over this.
Yeah, I wonder I mean, to me, I'm not sure that Petro is a very human face. There's still something rather grandiose about his way of addressing even one-on-one interviews. Mm. His use of rhetoric, even the sort of rhythms of the way he speaks. There's a very self-conscious statesmanship going on there that maybe is absolutely necessary. You know, I've certainly never sat down with Biden. I don't know what's required there in terms of social graces. I don't think it'll happen to me. I don't think I'll ever need to worry about it. But I'm not sure he's a human face as such. But he's certainly more of an adult face than Iván Duque. Certainly that, what was that? Was it BBC Sounds? That dreadful interview.
Oh, it was awful. A hard talk with,
Where he sort of did his usual sort of talking in incomprehensible statistics for a full half hour.
Mm.
And then at the end, when he was signing off, said this show should be called Hard Lies. And then wandered off. I mean, it was so, so childish and embarrassing. And I think Petro makes Colombia look like a serious, proper country in a way that Duque didn't manage to do.
Yeah, I think you're right on that hard talk one, because he kept saying, and it's been his policy now, and Vice President Marta Lucía Ramírez's policy, just to say, you know, we're backed up by facts, we're backed up by statistics, which are immediately you're able to question them immediately, or they're just the statistics. I mean, obviously that they prefer to show, and you know, there was no room for debate at all on that. You know, whoever it was, I don't know, Jonathan, I don't remember who was the interviewer, but you know, he presented the opposition, and they resent it, and then they say, well, I don't follow social media gossip. I've got the hard facts, which seems so easy to. And at the end, at the same time, it felt to me that Duque was expecting, you know, like his own auto interview that was in English, sent out during the Paro Nacional, which is like, no, you're going to have a credible journalist asking you questions. And on the Petro thing, I interviewed him many years ago when he was mayor. I also worked for him for 2 weeks. 2 weeks is kind of like my cutoff point for jobs. But I worked for two. But I interviewed him, and actually, you're very right. Now I recall, he sits in a louche fashion, I would say, not as bad as Rees-Mogg, but he sits very relaxed, and it is, yeah, the rhetoric is there, and it's not. You know, you don't feel like you're chatting to a person. You're someone who's far superior to you.
Which, you know, is a very traditional form of... I don't need politicians to be a sort of sweaty, blubbering, Boris Johnson-style wreck. I don't need that level of humanness. You know, a certain... you know, completely bash on the man, but I did meet him once, and he kept his bike helmet on the entire time. He was slightly pissed and very sweaty and wearing his bicycle helmet. Just a ridiculous, ridiculous man. And it would be nice, you know, to see a statesman with a level of grace slightly above that. But you're right, louche. I think louche and aloof and such words still do apply, Petro, but you know, he's the president of a republic.
Yeah,
maybe you're allowed a bit.
I can just imagine Boris with his hat on still, and obviously half pissed. And I imagine probably left his hat on in case he fell over.
I just lost you for like 30 seconds.
Okay, I said, oh, well, a second. I think, I imagine he left his hat on in case he fell over half pissed, you know.
And then probably took it off to ride home. I mean, I just, anyway.
Let's sort of tie up. I'm just going to look through and see if there's anything we haven't covered. And I know that Ben, well, no, Zach as well, asked about the sort of mayor of Bogota. And, you know, and he said, you know, that would seem to have been a major stepping stone towards gaining wider credibility since formerly being an armed rebel. How was it that a former armed rebel became mayor of Colombia's capital, and this has not served to affording him wider credibility even amongst the non-leftist electorate? There's so much stigma attached to being the left in Colombia. And also in response to that, Colombia is kind of the rebellious city when it comes to voting in that fashion. You know, there's a counterweight in the Palacio Liovano sitting alongside the Congress and the Palacio Nariño, and it just seems to go that way a bit. I don't know. Again, Bogota being, you described it actually as the more adult city question and answer some months ago.
That's the sort of thing I would say.
Yeah, and so I kind of feel on that a bit. It's just the Bogota votes differently, it being the big city with sort of all walks of life in that one. So I just get that one. And the mayoralty is, you know, when I talked to a friend in Bucaramanga who was voting for Rodolfo, and I said, you know, you have to understand that Rodolfo wasn't that successful as mayor of Bucaramanga. He has his position on corruption. So he froze every single contract in the city, which meant for 4 years you had every construction job frozen. I mean, it was all up in the air and on bricks. Now, I'm not saying that freezing contracts to weed out corruption is the wrong thing to do, but it left the city on bricks. And she said the response was, well, Petro wasn't a great mayor of Bogota either. No, under no circumstances can we say he was. But the dialogue and the narrative surrounded the, you know, the failure of the waste disposal scheme. That's what we talk about. He brought gun violence way down. He did bring sort of water and electricity and recognized that South Bogota existed. And, it, you know, there was a more socially minded on that front, which we can't say for a lot of mayors. We can't say. But I don't think, but he did annoy everybody by getting up on the balconies and hollering. You know, that he hollering to the International Court and Human Rights and the International American International Court and whatever, that things weren't going to get done. And that's what I fear for the presidency.
My hope is that he knows that the stakes are too high for that now.
Hope so. Yeah, I hope so too.
Fingers crossed.
Ben had obviously a plan for the tourism sector. That was one of his questions. And I mean, as someone who works in tourism, Petro has identified tourism as a major economic driver in the country. So whatever that means, it's a good thing. I don't know what that means yet. I don't know if that means improved infrastructure. I don't know if that means more grassroots involvement, which I would think is the most important from my perspective in a small town, grassroots involvement, getting communities involved on the ground, getting the people in these small towns involved in tourism, making it sustainable economically and environmentally is a huge step. I don't know where else to say. I mean, tourism will be a driver if you manage it correctly. That's more or less what I can say. I kind of steer clear of getting involved in the political side of things and just try and do things correctly from my own little corner. Are there any other things that we've missed out?
There was a question about whether or not major industrialists meeting with Petro.
Martin.
Yes, I've certainly not seen it reported. If they are.
The ANDI, the Association of like Businesses and stuff, have kind of made statements that they're prepared to meet. I think they may well have met, but I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, that's definitely an interesting question in the, you know, the broad church coalition that's being built. And lots of good profiling of, you know, I am meeting with this person from the right, I am meeting with this person from the center. We're not seeing so much of the direct contact with those sectors profiled in terms of PR. Though I noticed six former paramilitary leaders are joining the Acuerdo Nacional. So it really is the broadest of churches. But whether or not the big industrialists will join up, I don't know. I mean, you know, the model of big industry in Colombia is often monopolies, which are what Petro is saying that he wants to tackle. So,
So let's finish up with Julian again. And he said there's so much rumor around Petro. Well, that's the Venezuela. But he said, you know, what's the worst, what would and could be the best and worst case scenario for Colombia? Well, the best case scenario is Petro could carry out some actually socially minded, economically sustainable policies which bring Colombia forward into the 21st century enable public education for all, and that the poorest can eat three meals a day again, I think, and land reform and everything. Well, the worst case scenario for me is that everything is held in limbo and nothing gets done or only partially done, leaving it worse off, sort of like a half-built property or something. I don't know. I mean, what have you thought about this?
Yeah, I agree. Best case scenario, whether or not, you know, the pendulum swings back right, is that there will be, you know, there has been a demonstrated desire, we've ticked that box, but a demonstrated capacity for the government to provide state services to people who have not had them. And when we talk about a swing to the left, you know, these are not people who've like read Mein Kampf and then read Capital and been like, oh, I think Marx was right, not Hitler. That's not what we're talking about here at all.
No.
We're talking about people who see a chance for positive change in their own conditions of life. And Petro and Francia Márquez have promised that. So the best case scenario is that we see a shift in governments towards governments who want to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who want to not redistribute all wealth or create agriculture camps. We're not talking about that. We're talking about reaching people, providing something in exchange for the taxes that you charge. Of course, worst case scenario is that it's all a complete disaster and the pendulum swings hard right again and we go back to governments whose only real aim is shaking hands with US presidents and ripping out coca bushes and putting heads on sticks and saying, oh, look, I've got the leader of the Gulf plan. Like, have you? Or is there a new one immediately? Because, you know, I mean, so worst case scenario for me is continuity, frankly. Yeah. And a more entrenched continuity.
That answer on all fronts, that the capture of Otoniel has contributed to greater security for social and community leaders, is something that riles me every single time. It's like, oh, we captured it. And it's just like, and then the paro nacional occurred and show that you have no control over however much of the country. I don't know. You're going to get me on something that I'm likely to rant about.
But we have got cross-institutional consensus on this now. So the Truth Commission report said the current security model does not contribute in a meaningful way to security. We get less security with the current security model. Extradition does not help. Eradication of crops when it's in a forced manner does not help. And that's an independent 6-year, 1,000-page report that Petro has said that he will comply with. So we're not just talking sort of single man theories. We're now talking various institutions and checks and balances are all in favor of a change towards, you know, no more heads on sticks, no more crop eradication by force, and no more internal enemy attitudes, which are another major problem.
And I think that kind of ties in nicely to people who asked about the peace accords. I mean, if Petro is planning to follow the you know, the dialogue and the what is in the what do you call it again, the Truth Commission, then that's very much the peace accords, really, and what is being addressed there. Anything you want to say, Emily?
Well, quite, yeah.
Anything else? Any more for
Gosh,
any more?
No.
We've covered a lot.
Into COVID brainy and ranty. We have covered a lot. I'm just looking over my list of questions.
And I don't want anyone to be left out. I mean, Javier, I feel that I didn't ask about say anything about inflation. It's global. I mean, we're going to get to 11% here in UK. I don't know what we can do for that. The financial flight, it's not something new in Colombia. Those who can or have too much maybe get it out. I don't know. It's not something new that people invest in Miami.
Yeah, I mean, one of the other issues with Colombia, of course, in terms of financial flight, is corruption and money laundering. If you're worried about the money that's leaving Colombia, don't look to the few in the middle classes who are able to get their money out. Look at the very visibly wealthy in Colombia who set up enormous businesses in Miami, who have property empires in Florida, who are suddenly very rich and nobody knows why, who launder millions of dollars worth of filthy money through cattle companies, through, let's say, large supermarket chains that we won't mention the name of. This is the sort of financial flight that I think the focus will shift towards under Petro. And again, you know, the concerns of Colombians about their money and about politics are real and are valid and need to be addressed. But actually the amount of money that's leaving Colombia from those sorts of flights is much less than the amount of illegitimate money that could be brought under tax and under state control, if managed well.
I think we'll leave it there, Emily. I think we've spoken massively about this. I wish you all the best in this recovery. Don't go to the cinema again. That's where it happened.
Certainly not to see the film Elvis. And I don't want to start a war on Twitter. But good God, was that a waste of three hours.
I was going to say, at least I hope the film was good, but you saw Elvis. Was that Baz Luhrmann?
Was, and I am patchily a Luhrmann fan, on and off. Romeo and Juliet,
which was great for teenagers.
Incredible. Yeah. I watch that Romeo and Juliet every couple of years. It's completely fantastic. Yeah. Moulin Rouge, if you're hungover enough, is a decent film. But this was a mess. Come for me on Twitter. I'm ready for it. That's one of the worst films I've seen in years.
At Emily_H_H. Get it? It's out there for everyone. Listen. Thank you so much, Emily. Get better. We're three minutes apart.
Thank you.
At some point in the next month, our paths will cross in person.
I hope so. Have a great time in Paris. I shall.
When this comes out, I will be in Paris for the first time ever. I've never been to Paris before.
Really?
So taking the family to Paris. Yes.
How lovely.
Yes,
how lovely. Enjoy.
So now we'll go over to a few words from our sponsors. Thank you to Emily Hart again. Another great episode, 432. And we'll be back next week, of course. At some point this summer, we'll take a week off because it is the summer holidays. But we will take a week off. But yes, we'll be back next week, of course, with more interviews and conversations about things Colombia related. Emily is getting better because she can talk. And of course, her so coherent and so on the ball. We are always very grateful to that.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And we are always happy for those of you out there supporting us on Patreon. A thank you to William, who signed up this week in Bogota to support us on Patreon. Patreon.com/Colombia Calling. That's all for the week, and goodbye. This episode was brought to you by Latin News, a leading source of political and economic analysis on Latin America and the Caribbean. Since 1967, their flagship publication, the Latin American Weekly Report, provides a behind-the-scenes briefing on all the week's key developments throughout the region. Sign up for a 14-day free trial at latinnews.com. And also, our other sponsor is BNB Colombia Tours, experts in custom-made travel throughout Colombia. The team at BNB Colombia Tours can provide you with fantastic
private experiences, creating wonderful memories of Colombia for a lifetime. Check out the website at bnbcolombia.com, complete the free itinerary form, and tell them that Colombia Calling sent you to receive a further 5% off their already great prices. So that's bnbcolombia.com and, of course, latinnews.com. Thank you for everyone for listening. That's us. Farewell. And, of course, check back next week. Bye-bye. La canoa de Bareque para llegar a